Welcome, Left Reckoning patrons. I'm Matt Leck. With me is always David Griscom.
Howdy.
And joining us this episode is Sam Hoadley Brill. Sam is someone who I, at Deontologist.
Deontologist.
Deontologist. That is an important distinction. Yes, thank you. On Twitter, somebody who whose work on that website has been very valuable to me covering this, what I'm calling the CRT party that the GOP is throwing to try to rile up a little bit of right-wing populist fervor heading into the midterms. We have a clip from, you have a YouTube page people can subscribe to, that's your name, Sam Hoadley Brill. This clip from Parents Gone Wild, I think, just to set the table for what has been going on in school boards. And we'll maybe return to the similar issue in terms of anti-mask stuff and anti-vax stuff with parents. But I actually think that while that's more in vogue right now, I think that might not age as well as this stuff is going to. So I think this is more important to cover right now.
Stop indoctrinating our children. Stop teaching our children to hate the police. Stop teaching our children that if they don't agree with the LGBT community, that they're homophobic. Or saying that any child that doesn't believe in Black Lives Matter should be canceled out. Is this what my tax dollars is paying for? You're teaching my children and other children that if they believe in God Almighty, they're part of a cult. Do you want the proof? I have the proof. You created a curriculum of Black Panther indoctrination. Why can't we let the public know that you're teaching our children to go out and murder our police officers? Do you want the proof? I have the proof. Is that what scares you, the proof? You work for me. I don't work for you.
On that note, I think it's a good place as any to stop there. Now, I have a message of empathy about these people being bum steer victims, as me and David like to pose it, but I can't say it too close to her actually spewing that shit. So I'm going to throw to you, Sam, to help contextualize like what we're seeing from these school board meetings.
I mean, just there's a lot of it. It's a sort of like endless cycle, like a feedback loop of sort of Chris Rufo and James Lindsay-esque sort of faux experts in critical race theory who feed information to Fox News and other conservative media outlets. That goes out into the airwaves and people consume it. And then they're convinced that their children are being indoctrinated by whatever it is. And then maybe they get a hold of some materials that say something like equity or justice, or even just the word anti-racism is apparently too much for a lot of these people. And then they get the opportunity to take the microphone at a school board meeting and they go wild.
It's funny. It's words like systemic, like in injustice, words that actually like the Democratic Party is getting used to saying now, ironically, which is just the perfect storm of like not getting anywhere and then conditioning people to get super pissed off and afraid by what is basically like in the grand historical sweep of this, like this is a tricky situation for any country to deal with, is like this inheritance of this history, right? And how are we going to basically break it to people? And I do think there are clumsy ways to do it that are being fanned by the right, for instance. At the same time, like, you're training kids to kill police officers. Like, we're at a level of like derangement at that point. And then like the thing of you work for me, like this was similar in that the mama bear who was the former Miss California who said like you do your jobs or whatever she said, like the exact same message, right? Which is like I want to compel you to do this. Like, this is framed as these people are somehow freedom fighters, but this is actually them compelling teachers. And often we're seeing teachers getting fired over like sharing a Ta-Nehisi Coates article. Again, not the most radical thing in the world, but to some people it reads as like Molotov cocktail throwing like race warrior.
Yeah. it's terrifying. I would hate to be a public school teacher in about half of the states in the country right now.
Yeah.
And I want to focus on the CRT stuff and like the actual claims and things in a moment, but you know, this is something that you look at what's going on with these school board meetings, and there's a bit of it that's like, I mean, it's exceptionally American, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of hysteria about all these kind of things, but like trying to zoom out a little bit more and think about it, like as in its relation to democracy, I think is interesting, right? Because like public school is like, you know, that's a leftist concept, right? Like the idea that like we're going to educate people for free as a public good, right? Is a value that I think, you know, because we're a couple centuries away from it, people sort of forget how important this is as like you know, a victory for the working class movement. What's interesting about the way that the right has sort of embedded itself into these fights is they don't treat it as something. It's like these school board meetings, like the way that they're talking, like you work for me kind of stuff, is very like a neoliberal kind of like market-based way of thinking about this, rather than like, you know, this is like a community discussion to talk about how we want to educate. Right. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, this is like, I'm the boss, you're the worker, you need to obey me, right? Which I just think just, I don't think that, you know, we can solve it by just coming from it from that lens, but I do think that it does really expose, like, I don't know, a crisis in the way a lot of us think about our institutions, both on the left and the right.
Well, go ahead, Sam, go ahead.
It's, if you go into like the full, so I, you know, chop up little bits of that, that clip for the purposes of like getting the highlights, but the some of the school board members are actually responding to her like, you know, no, we're not getting paid for this. This is like a volunteer position. Like, like it's pretty ridiculous.
You know, David, I think you're right to flag that school thing, because what that made me think of is, well, two things. One, like sort of teach-ins during the Vietnam era, but also what you, the like lessons from Syriza in Greece and the sort of aspirations for schools in Greece. I don't know if you can briefly remind us what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a point that I've picked up from Panitch. It's like, you know, Syriza, the party of the radical left in Greece, you know, they were real deal socialists. They want to do socialist things. And, you know, there was a tension within the party, though, because they actually didn't have like enough, they weren't embedded enough in like the working class, even though they had the support of them, they weren't embedded enough to sort of like direct and organize on a local level. And like a great example of this is like the education minister. Right. A great radical socialist said that, like, I want to turn schools into community centers, labor centers for workers to do political education, have union meetings, etc. Right. Which is a great strategy. But there was that lack of connection between the party itself and the people. Right. So the education minister was saying, I want to do this, but they didn't know who to call, you know, to make it happen, right? Because that's the kind of different way of governing than like, you know, most education systems function, right? Yeah, so it's like thinking about democracy in that like kind of wider lens, I think it's a really critical thing for socialists to understand, so we can start, you know, laying the groundwork for doing the kinds of things in schools and in those public spaces that we're certainly not doing. And even, you know, when we come into power, there's going to be a lot more work that needs to be done than just being able to say from the top, you know, we're going to turn these schools into radical, you know, hobbits, which is a great example, by the way, as much as like the right loves to have these conspiracies that schools are just like these big socialist factories. Like, even if we did control the government, we wouldn't be able to do that kind of stuff without doing the community work on the first hand, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So let's move on to the guy who's sort of poisoning the well here. The lead one, I think I've been sort of framing Rufo and Lindsay as sort of a double act, where Rufo's the like guy who's, you can take to like nice restaurants and stuff.
Yeah.
But, and Lindsay's the guy who's like, I don't know,
the guy in his mom's basement in the back, like, you know, eating Cheeto puffs and shit, but like feeding Rufo all his material.
Yeah, but occasionally like a Rufo and company will invite him out because he'll like smash his head into the wall if they like dare him to or something. Yeah. Like that. But so before we get to Lindsay, which we're anticipating again by our eagerness, who is Chris Rufo? How did he cross your radar? And, you know, I think I just want to say up front, like, I don't think these guys are, I think if you were engage these guys as worthy interlocutors in a debate, you're doing a disservice to anybody who's following that debate, because the message that sends is they're worthy of that.
I think, and I've tried, but right, I get blocked.
As so, you'll see, yeah. like you, because we have this tweet I'll put up in a little bit where he, the way he asks for extreme charity in interpretation of him, as he takes the most like BS interpretations of things is, I think, very telling. I think this guy is just a reactionary plant. Who's
he's like, I think of him as basically like the Dinesh D'Souza of the 2020s. Like, basically, so I came across him through starting with my work on just like looking at James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose. So I like my history with that whole scene, right? They came onto the scene really in 2018 with their Grievance Studies hoax. And I had like seen clips of that on like, you know, him and Lindsay and Bogosian on Joe Rogan talking about what they did. And with no further context, I was like, huh, seems like they might have actually, you know, exposed some flaws in academia, but I didn't look into it on my own at all because, and then, you know, of course, as a matter of fact, once I did, it turns out that it was all sort of just boisterous, you know, just rhetoric. Exploiting people,
this event for folks who might not be familiar with it.
So the Grievance Studies affair in 2018 was essentially a team of three. They postured as academics, but really it was James Lindsay, who was a math PhD who had left academia after getting his degree because he had really no job prospects as a, you know, University of Tennessee math PhD. And Peter Bogosian, who got an EdD. I recently found out that he had been kicked out of the philosophy PhD program at the University of either New Mexico or Arizona, which I didn't know before. But so he ended up getting an EdD and got a job in the philosophy department at Portland State University. So he was the one, I guess, technically academic of the trio. And Helen Pluckrose, who left a literature PhD program, I believe. She was in a lit degree and left. She got her master's, but bailed before she could get her PhD. And so the three of them decided to, but it was mainly James Lindsay. Like, Lindsay was like salaried to do this by an undisclosed donor.
Do we have any inclination of who was behind that funding?
Not certain, but we do know that nowadays he's under the payroll of a guy named, oh my God, what's his name? He's this Christian nationalist guy, Sovereign Nations.
Right.
Mike something. Oh man, Aaron's gonna kill me. Aaron Rabinowitz at Embrace the Void podcast has a lot of good work on exposing that guy. But basically, he's with Sovereign Nations.
And this being a guy who came up as a new atheist sort of guy, is that
James Lindsay, a new atheist. The three of them actually met through the new atheism movement. So Bogosian wrote a book called like A Manual for Creating Atheists, which got like some blurb from Dawkins and the skeptic guy, who's a skeptic magazine guy.
Oh, Shermer.
Yeah.
Yep. Of course. Yep.
Those people. And so that's how Bogosian came to be. He was like, I teach critical thinking. You know, I love reason and evidence, and I hate faith, all that stuff. And so they actually met through the new atheism movement. James Lindsay had written books about like something about everyone's wrong about God or something like that. And
so he's like a late comer, like he's a professional late comer to these things, ain't he?
Yeah. And so then they decided, so James Lindsay and Peter Bogosian had like one too many conversations about how gender studies is a bunch of, you know, manure, and it's all awful, and we need to expose this madness. And so they wrote a bunch of hoax papers.
Right? Yeah, and I just want to characterize, because I recently listened to the I Don't Speak German podcast, and they have two really good episodes on Lindsay. The third one coming out, I think, that go into the nature of these hoaxes. And they are really shoddy shit, honestly. Like, one of them is point blank, the one that they got through, is my understanding, is they just made up the data for this observation of these gender dogs.
A couple of them, actually.
Right, which is like, that's not something peer review is meant to find. That's something that further studies will reproduce, or they're not, and then that will be a discussion for something that gets peer reviewed. Peer review doesn't have the capacity to go and like find fraud at that level. It's a simple, complete misunderstanding of the process.
There's no way to verify that the data was actually collected as it is reported.
Like, exactly.
There's just,
And, but there was in the peer review process questions like, hey, what is your methodology? So it was like asked, right? And then even to go to James's name, Conceptual James.
Wait, before we go too far, I just want to make sure that everyone's following us, like on this paper specifically, right?
Yeah.
This paper that they put in, and if I remember correctly, it's in a journal that like also like has a, like as part of its mission statement, like, you know, a desire to sort of print things that might not be picked up by other journals, right?
It wasn't so
it's already like an eccentric journal on its own, but they wrote a few papers that got picked up in like, you know, gender studies, academic journals. Most of them were, you know, in journals that sort of, you know, they publish a lot of different things that, you know, are sort of ideas to catch the things that are being missed, right? These aren't like the most prestigious journals out there, but the one that Matt's talking about, they wrote a piece, something about like, you know, like the gender dynamics of like dog parks, and they made an argument or something like that about how like dog parks are like sexist and like you know, too masculine or something of that nature, right? And it's supposed to, you know, it's supposed to be, you know, titillating, and you'd be like, oh wow, look how insane these people are that they're publishing this kind of stuff. But as Matt was saying, is
like, if you go and look at the paper itself, and if the data actually were like real, it's a compelling paper. Like it, like they would actually be making an interesting point. That so I run a little Substack. I haven't posted in a long time, but I had a guest post by a guy named Nestor DeBuen, who went and actually like sort of did a debunking of the hoax aspect of this paper. So if folks are interested in that, that's a conceptualdisinformation.substack.com. And yeah, Nestor DeBuen's guest post on the dog park paper.
Yeah, I just want to mention like the conceptual James thing too, right? That's another version of this. What I believe the paper was something like
the conceptual penis.
Conceptual penis. Do like fat men have a penis? But the study, if you actually look at it, and like, look, you can roll your eyes at this sort of like use of terminology if you want. But the study is looking at representations in media as like overweight men being basically being unsexed or look like basically represented as non-sexual, right? So like that's an actual question that another, again, it looks on the face of it absurd to maybe like the crowd that they're trying to you know, make feel like the world is ending, but it's actually compared to shit you see in like evolutionary psychology or like neoliberal economics, like particularly if you just make up evidence, which is I repeat, like that's nothing new, that like fraud can get through. Look at the Lancet Andrew Wakefield autism thing, where like I don't know if he was either making up the methodology or it was just a really small sample size and they just shouldn't have let it through, but either way, like this stuff, mistakes happen, like surprise, and that they had to go through, like, again, not even a gender studies journal to get this dog park one in.
And the conceptual penis one, I forgot to actually mention this. They tried before they did the grievance studies hoax, which got like 7 papers accepted total, with like 50 total, I think, submissions, with different, you know, there were like 20 papers, but 50 different submissions to, cause they submitted papers to more than one journal at a time, which you're not supposed to actually do. Before they did that, they tried this conceptual penis hoax in 2017, which was just Peter and James together. And they submitted it to a journal where it was accepted, where it was a pay-to-publish journal. And so as soon as they tried to come public with the hoax, everyone was like, you didn't prove anything. Like, there are journals like this in every field that will accept nonsensical papers. This is not an indictment of gender studies at all. And then they were sort of backtracking for a little bit, trying to justify it. And then they realized, okay, no, we're going to have to try something else. And then they went on the year and a half venture to indict gender studies and other grievance studies, in their words, fields. But they only ever got papers published that had to do with gender and sexuality. So whenever, and this happens all the time when I get into arguments with people on Twitter about like the legitimacy of, or the, the legitimacy of citing someone like James Lindsay as an authority on critical race theory, none of the papers published had anything to do with race. So that's like, but people will be like, did you get any papers published in these fields? Like, are you an authority on this? It's exhausting, but that's how they got into all this.
And I just want to circle back to Boghossian too. Bogosian's been complaining that none of the liberal media wants to like interview him because he resigned from university, to which like I immediately thought of the guy asking Logan Paul for a job after he quit like some sort of finance job. It's like, but the funny thing about him resigning is he was investigated as part of this by the university for, I think, a decent reason, which is that this is an experiment that you are running on peer reviewers and you are not getting their consent to do that. And that might seem like a simple thing, but like when these guys get on their high horse about experimental consent, say for instance, a vaccine or things like that, like I think it's, you can raise your eyebrow a little tiny bit. Mm. I have something I want to play about. We have a few funny things of conceptual James. First is this clip I have from the I Don't Speak German podcast, episode 94. And this is James Lindsay, where he was rebuked by a historian for not for basically misusing. I don't know. Can you remember the context of this a little bit better, Sam?
So one of the hoax papers was accepted and they branded it as intersectional Mein Kampf. So they were like, we took a chapter of Mein Kampf, and then instead of making it about Nazism, we made it about intersectional feminism, and they still published it. Like, look at these evil people using Hitlerian language or accepting this kind of language. And so this, I think his name is Michael Nielsen. He's a Swedish historian whose area of expertise is Hitler and Nazi Germany. And so he went and looked at the paper that they branded as intersectional Mein Kampf, a rewrite of, I believe, chapter 12 of Mein Kampf. And he went through and was like, wait a minute, this is they changed all the substantive language. Right. So in chapter 12 of Mein Kampf is like, you know, Hitler saying like, we need to have a movement. This is what the movement will be like. And so basically the entire thing is just, oh, intersectional feminists need a movement. This is what the movement will be like. And so all of the, it's just, right. I recommend people read Michael Nielsen's paper about it. It's in Haaretz. But Matt, let's hear this.
I mean, I think it's just interesting, like, yeah, the use of their use of language. Again, James is a mathematician. That's an important context because he's not an English major. So I don't expect him to have maybe the best understanding of this. This clip is a very good demonstration of the virtue of the humanities, anyway.
Okay. So we have a historian dealing with Hitler, right? And he's writing this thing. First thing he points out here, what does based on Mein Kampf actually mean? The first thing he does is he tries to point out that this chapter 12, isn't that bad. Okay. Then he doesn't even deal with the situation honestly. So I'm going to deal with the situation honestly. So deals with how the newly refounded NSDAP should rebuild as a party and amplify its program. As we've learned many times so far on the New Discourses podcast, I'm not that good at the original German. But what is the NSDAP? So I went to my favorite not Google search engine and typed in NSDAP. That's all I typed. Press enter. What's the top result that comes back? Wikipedia, Nazi Party. Yeah, so NSDAP stands for National Socialistische Deutsche Arbeiter Party. In other words, the Nazi Party. The National Socialist German, I don't know what Arbeiter means in German, party. Anyway, the point is, this is the Nazi Party. But why didn't he just say that? Why did he hide it behind NSDAP, which obviously most readers would not recognize? Why didn't he just call it the Nazi Party?
I mean, he called it the Nazi Party, just with the acronym. Like, I don't.
Oh, my goodness.
James, Arbiter, if you know anything about like the context of what you're discussing, maybe Hitler might be talking about the Nazi Party. You might know that. Also, Arbiter, Arbeit macht frei. You know, again, mathematicians. But unbelievable, thinking he's trying to be sneaky. That's like if I say the DNC, it's like, you mean the Democrats? It's like, yeah.
You mean liberals.
Sure. Why don't you just say it? Yeah. I think, unless we have anything more to say, do I have anything more to say on Lindsay? I'm looking at my notes here.
I guess I never really got wrapped around to say how they connected to Rufo.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so like basically, like, I got into Rufo through Lindsay. Lindsay, I was covering because I was writing a review of the book that he wrote with Helen Pluckrose that came out called Cynical Theories. It came out last year and was like a very, it was a bestseller, not on New York Times list, but on several other lists. You go to Amazon, it's got like thousands of five-star reviews, been wildly popular. And I was one of the only people to write like a negative review that really got any traction. Thankfully, someone put it in the Wikipedia article of the book so that people can see it when they read about the book. But yeah, I put that out in Liberal Currents. I read the book like with an open mind, ready to be convinced that in fact, you know, there postmodernism really is taking over the humanities. And I thought that I would be ready to, you know, I would be in a good position to evaluate it, having just taken a class the previous semester called Decolonial Feminist Ethics and Epistemology, right? So any of the stuff that they're demonizing, I was going to be reading about. And much of the stuff that they ended up demonizing in the book, I in fact had read already. And I had some objections to certain things, of course, but they were completely mischaracterizing the work and then attacking the straw man that they had erected. So, I mean, I wrote the review of that, and James, Lindsay, and Helen Pluckrose both blocked me very quickly on social media after that went public. And then I noticed this character, Christopher Rufo, coming out and working alongside James Lindsay to make critical race theory the next big thing in the moral panic. And I noticed this when Donald Trump made the executive order about a year ago now, where he specifically named critical race theory in one of the memos that preceded the executive order that was done by Russ Vaught, was one of his staffers. And then I saw Chris Rufo, you know, Chris Rufo's on Fox News talking to Tucker Carlson about critical race theory. And then the next day, you know, he's in the White House or whatever. And it wasn't exactly the next day, just in case he's watching this and tries to, you know, swipe some audio for his next big dunk. He's all about, you know, debunking people, and in just as we'll see later, I'm sure the least charitable reconstruction of everyone's views. But I saw, you know, on Twitter, Rufo is like interacting with Lindsay, and Lindsay starts ramping things up and starts contradicting the book in certain ways, talking about critical race theory, because he wanted to make everything about the Frankfurt School now rather than postmodernism, when the book is all about postmodernism. As I found out, that was because Helen Pluckrose wrote the majority of the book, and James Lindsay was sort of there adding little shitty metaphors and gotchas. But
look, this is true to the Enlightenment values, where you have a woman do all the work and a man take care of
the and yeah, he'll take all the credit for it. But yeah, Lindsay came along and started doing his whole Frankfurt School, you know, resurrecting this, you know, this neo-Nazi conspiracy theory that is now like virtually mainstream in the Republican Party, which is terrifying. Mm-hmm. But that's how I became acquainted with Rufo. He started getting on all these Fox News programs, and, you know, it was all over the media, and actually working with legislators when Biden took office, rescinded the executive order on the first day, and then it became a state fight. All these states advancing this legislation banning critical race theory.
Go ahead, David.
No, I mean, it just, the thing that's frustrating about trying to find a way to systemically like criticize these folks is that there truly is very little basis as to what their fundamental criticism is. I mean, like, as somebody, Sam, you know, spends a lot of time studying philosophy, you know how absurd it is to be talking about postmodernism in like relation to like the Frankfurt School, right?
Right.
James Lindsay describes that CRT is essentially race Marxism, which is another wild, you know, just wild concept. And, you know, I think for folks, you know, who might not, it's just they're frustrating, one, because as you were saying earlier, they're very quick to block, and they don't really like to debate or engage in you know, in debate or conversation around their ideas. And then when you try to go to their writings, it's all over the place. Which makes them sort of dangerous, because people's sort of unwillingness or like saying that, like, oh, well, it's difficult to talk to James because he's fucking batshit and he's talking about, you know, he doesn't really understand what he's talking about, makes it seem to, I think, some people on the outside, like, oh, he's just so powerful and has such a big brain that nobody can criticize him. But how can you criticize somebody who's saying that, you know, CRT is a postmodern Frankfurt school race Marxism, you know, system of thought, right? And then it also puts, I think, Marxists into a weird position as well, sometimes dealing with the CRT stuff, because, you know, there are like rich, you know, traditions of like conflict and debate between these two schools of thought as well. But you have to say like, okay, well, we have to destroy this straw man. I don't know. It's tough to figure out the best way sometimes to go about criticizing them, other than to just expose their lack of knowledge on all these different fronts, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's really difficult. And one thing to point out is that there are, as you said, you know, there are lots of conflict historically over, you know, the sort of classical Marxists and other schools of Marxism and folks like critical race theorists. One paper I think is worth, if people are just interested in checking out more about this conflict, rest in peace, the late great Charles Mills, who passed away just over a week ago, was one of my mentors and my professor at the CUNY Graduate Center, where I'm a student. He has a great paper talking about, you know, or responding to a Marxist criticism of critical race theory. Mm-hmm. Charles Mills was earlier, you know, a sort of classical Marxist in his early career, and then went on to become a kind of like Marx inspired radical liberal, as he puts it. And he has a paper responding to a critique of critical race theory, talking about how there can be Marxist and non-Marxist critical race theorists, and it's not such a split line. So folks could check that out. We'll put a link somewhere or something.
Yeah, no, that for sure.
One of the big tells, I think, came in, and you can give us the context here, but I really like the way you put this tweet, because I think this is a pattern you can identify with a lot of these kind of guys. And here's the tweet, yeah, put it up. So you say of Rufo, what is far more damning here is that Rufo feels entitled to be given such charitable treatment by anyone who writes about him publicly, given that he is a human antithesis to charitable journalism. Sam, what was the how were you uncharitable to Rufo? I mean,
oh yeah, if you scroll up, you can see that I got an email from his assistant. So I wrote an article that basically exposed just dozens of examples of Chris Rufo lying or being sloppy and getting stuff wrong. And this is in the next one down, the second one in the thread. This is Rufo's assistant. I'm writing to you concerning an article posted on your site about Christopher Rufo. And the thing that he took issue with was my quote from the article. Rufo seems to think that his reader ought to take him at his word that a Missouri middle school teacher articulated this objection based on his familiarity with the work of the abstruse neo-Marxist philosopher Herbert Marcuse, that someone present remembered it accurately, and that this person communicated the episode accurately as reported. I just don't buy it. So it's me saying, I just don't buy it, which then was interpreted as a claim of fabrication, which is like, no. I'm saying that, you know, I don't buy it personally. People can come to their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. But then Rufo, right, like, is expecting everyone to be charitable to him, and he's out here making claims of just absolute, like, completely unverifiable, just nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. That's not even, like, libel in country or slander, whatever he's calling it.
Right.
Like, in countries that are... first of all, I think you're right. Second of all, even if you were wrong, that is like editorializing. That's not like you're allowed to do that, especially when you frame it as that. But go ahead, David.
No, I'm just saying the free speech guys that get very, very, very quiet. Like, they love to bully folks, right?
Yeah.
And they not only like, you know, the emails or things like that, but, you know, people are always afraid of litigation from these folks because they love, you know, I don't want to speak specifically about these guys. But, you know, a lot of people in those, you know, those kind of right anti-woke circles are very happy to lawyer up with folks, especially when they can be, you know, sort of challenging independent journalists, people who aren't going to have people to help them out. Right. I don't know. It's funny to me. I mean, I don't know. At the same time, I sort of criticize folks who get too worked about the hypocrisy of the right, because the right is full of hypocrites. But
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, you talk about how threatening these bullies are. I mean, look at this. We have James Lindsay here talking about our friends at Left Flank Vets, warning them, denounce communism and thereby uphold your oath to the Constitution, then, Marine. Yeah. I love this guy using the word Marine. Like, bro, what? Like,
this is one thing that you have to do specifically with Lindsay, because Lindsay's whole shtick is like, I mean, half of his stuff, especially on Twitter, is literally just being a troll. Yep. The other half is like, I mean, is chest beating, you know, standing up and being the good patriot against the communist threat. And, you know, sometimes I hate to say it, like, if someone is engaging on these kind of like, you know, lower levels of intellectual discourse, just mainly insult. I don't know. You start to expose yourself to things. And when it comes to James, like, you don't really have to do too much digging to find a lot about him that is quite embarrassing. I mean, I was noting to folks, it's like, you know, the way James presents himself, even his profile pictures, if he's like this kind of like young, buff, tough guy. But, you know, he's a kind of schlubby older gentleman who has axe dancing videos. Like, this is not something that was found, by the way. This was a celebration video. This is how he celebrated, I think, 250,000 followers on Twitter, right? This is not found footage, right? This is something that he's putting out into the world. And look, you know, let your freak flag fly, man. I mean, I love it. But if you're going to sort of act like you're the alpha male, you know, this kind of character that you're not, I don't know. I think it's time to sort of calling those people out.
One final thing. I just want to play this, and if we have any more to say kind of on this theme of the Frankfurt School, but you have a good compilation here of this guy from 1999, the Free Congress Foundation. I forget his name.
That's got to be William Lind. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds awfully familiar. I got to say.
Yeah, it sounds like shish. It could have come out yesterday.
For the first time, Americans today are not free to say what they think. If they say something deemed offensive or insensitive or, worst of all, hate speech, they may be in serious trouble. They may be punished for violating the unholy commandments of the 90s, commonly known as political correctness.
There's a new religion stalking our land, and it's rapidly becoming the dominant religion. Certainly the
most. And this did come out yesterday, basically, this part.
Just in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. It seems to have taken over nearly every part of our ruling class. This new religion is wokeism.
Is political correctness a new phenomenon? We'll show you tonight that political correctness has been in the making for more than 8 decades.
It is the product of a 100-year-long effort to undermine and tear down the values and ideals and freedoms that this country was built on.
And it seems that a deteriorating society is exactly what political correctness strives for.
What we're seeing today is not a fleeting cultural moment. It is the realization of a planned and patiently executed campaign to destroy our society.
Now, I must admit, I'm not super familiar with Steve Hilton, but I mean, that's boilerplate Fox News at this point.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, at the end of that segment, so if you go, like, for folks who are more interested, go through the rest of the thread, and you'll see at the end of this segment where I'm pulling these clips of Steve Hilton from, he says, if anyone's interested in learning more, I highly recommend the work of James Lindsay. And then he says, you know, go read his book, Cynical Theories, even though, once again, Cynical Theories does not mention the Frankfurt School as a key figure in all of this, because Helen Pluckrose wrote the book, and she's more concerned about Derrida and Foucault than any of this Marxist stuff.
What do you think about that inclusion or that shift? What do you guys make of that?
So what I gather is that from just reading Helen Pluckrose, is she's more sympathetic to actual Marxism and sort of neo-Marxist, basically left-wing economic arguments. So she's like sort of down with at least democratic socialist type ideas and arguments. You know, she's from England. There's a more of a tolerance for, like, you know, on Europe, you know, what's considered like more like center left there is like radical left over here in America often. Mm-hmm. in terms right. of the economic arguments, at least.
Also, she has the lived experience of being her having her labor exploited by these two gentlemen. So.
Exactly, exactly. The lived experience.
And remind me again where she's at.
Somewhere in England.
She's in the UK. She's in the UK.
Yeah,
she's kind of distanced herself, I guess, from some of this a little bit because of how crazy James has gotten.
Yeah, but hardly really. It's a lot of posturing for the most part. Like she claims, and in the book, they claim to stand up for the values of liberalism. I mean, you can't call James Lindsay a liberal nowadays. Like you go through his timeline, he's just an anti-radical. Like he's just like, it's like John Birch Society stuff.
Yeah, it's there's no other way to put it than like reactionary. I mean, it's like, it's pure reaction from Lindsay, at least his ideology.
Well, I think we're not done with these two gentlemen. Like I said, I think the vaccine stuff, it's reaching new heights because some people have some new basketball players to root for. But I don't think that, I think this stuff is going to be the bread and butter of what they try to run
2022.
On.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the thing is like, and I think that video that you put together is so perfect to explain it. Cause this is the like fundamental like bent of a lot of American conservatism, right? It's just moral panic that whatever, you know, be it, you know, people who are arguing for racial integration or whatever, you know, that they've infiltrated everything. And now, you know, the voices of like reaction and bigotry are now being silenced in American society. I don't know. Like it's the same old game that we've been reading for a very, very long time. I think the kind of disappointing thing is that, you know, Frankfurt School is interesting. Don't get me wrong, but you know, there's been some developments over the past few decades. It's a little sad. That, like, James Lindsay is like just doing plagiarism of like, you know, 70s and 80s like reaction.
Yeah,
these people like the whole Frankfurt School conspiracy theory was really drawn up by William Lind and Paul Weyrich of the Free Congress Foundation. Paul Weyrich was a guy who coined the phrase the moral majority and was instrumental in getting Reagan elected for the first time, going focusing on, you know, evangelical communities and making the whole pro-life coalition. And they basically, or it was mostly Lind, as far as I can tell from my research. I got a friend and colleague, Andrew Woods, who's writing a dissertation right now on the history of this sort of Frankfurt School cultural Marxism conspiracy theory. But the term cultural Marxism is basically just a sort of Americanization Anglicization, Englishifying of the term cultural Bolshevism, which was a Nazi term, like literally the Nazis. And they use that to refer to anything that they saw as sort of degenerate. Cultural Marxism, in the words of William Lind, is Marxism translated from economic into cultural terms. And that is basically political correctness. And this whole political correctness panic from the 90s, they sort of capitalized on and used to tie it to the Frankfurt School, which then they could use to dog whistle to anti-Semites, etc.
You know, this is an observation that I've made a couple times on the show about like the cultural Marxism. Whenever James is like, oh, they're substituting, you know, the proletariat for, you know, the oppressed and then, you know, whatever. All right. He does these kind of cheap substitutions and he's like, well, this means that it's Marxism. But like as somebody who spends time, you know, reading and studying, understanding like the history of ideas, the idea of like oppressed versus oppressor was not the contribution that Marxism gave to philosophy, right? Like Marxism did a very specific thing, which was talk about exploitation under capitalism, not create the concept of oppressed versus oppressor. I mean, that's Disney movie shit, right? That's like parables, bro.
It goes back to Thrasymachus. Like go open up Plato's Republic. Like, like the first thing Thrasymachus comes in, he's like, justice is just whatever the just, you know, the powerful say it is. And I literally open up a paper where I'm talking about Marxism and any room for a kind of ethics in Marxism, like because there's this sort of paradox, you know, Marx says that morality he describes like under the heading of ideology. Right. And if ideology is supposed to be sort of epistemologically suspect, right, or defective in some way, then you have this kind of oh, well, like, is there any room, or is he just sort of talking about bourgeois morality, mm-hmm. right? Like, is he just talking about the idea of justice under, you know, what the capitalists have prescribed under the current paradigm? Like, and then I compare that to, you know, the phrase from the German ideology is something like, the ruling ideas in every epoch are the ideas of the ruling class. Mm-hmm. And there's something that's almost word for word in Thrasymachus in the Republic, when he's like, just, you know, justice is just whatever the ruling say.
Right. 100%. It's so frustrating, because I know Ben wrote a piece in the pieces. Ben Burgess wrote a piece, and the piece is very interesting and great. But the title alone, I think, is like is a challenge to the right, which is that Marx deserves better critics, right? Because
for
like
real,
there's a lot of stuff to dance with, and there's tensions. I mean, like, I consider myself a Marxist, so I, for the most part, would, you know, side up in the Marxist camp. But like, there's a lot of discussions and debates to be had, and it is frustrating. That the ones that we're having publicly right now are these kind of cheap substitutions. I'd also want to add too, regarding the Frankfurt School and like the plot aspect of it, right? That they say is like, mm-hmm. oh, this is like the idea that the Marxists came up with.
100-year-long spear.
Yeah, you know, they're gonna do this secret substitution. A lot of like Marxists and at least like politically active socialists today, especially, but all throughout since the beginning of the Frankfurt School, criticize the Frankfurt School for their cultural turn, right?
Yeah.
Which is that actually like the fixation that the Frankfurt School had on culture was like a reaction to like, the difficulties of socialist organizing in that period of time. And the fact that left philosophy went in that cultural like direction was one, both a reaction to defeat, but also contributed to the weakness of the left today, right? Like, and that's like a very sustained like Marxist criticism of the Frankfurt School that is not at all on the fringes. Like, that's actually like a pretty like mainstream criticism of the Frankfurt School. So again, like, I mean, it's all one, the original thesis from Lindsay is insane, right? But mm-hmm. the idea that there's just like this kind of uniform position of like Marxists and socialists in support of the Frankfurt School is also ludicrous. It's
insane.
Yeah.
And there's this history of the Frankfurt School. I think Grand Hotel Abyss, I think it's mm-hmm. called.
Yeah,
is a book. And in the beginning, they talk about how this whole like conspiratorial framing of things is just so misguided, because contemporary Marxists, as you said, are already criticizing them for this kind of lack of focus on material conditions and the lack of the radical spirit of Marx that they have that they have actually departed from.
And ironically, like, people at the time were criticizing folks within the Frankfurt School, not of creating a radical plot to undermine Western values or even capitalism itself, but actually like turning Marxism into a bourgeois philosophy,
exactly. Right?
To make Marxism palatable and acceptable to the ruling class, to like allow it to like exist, right? it's too much.
I mean, well, guys, I think what this makes me think is that maybe next time we do this, we don't talk about these two fucking clowns. Instead, we talk about like actual philosophy.
Before we go, I want to give people one little treat, just because Matt hasn't seen this and I want to share it, because we were talking about the critical race theory stuff at the beginning. And I think, you know, we could talk about like what this represents about the country and the right, etc. But you also have to remember that the class dynamics of these things are very clear. And Matt hasn't seen this yet, but this is a really great article in Reuters, right? This isn't gotcha journalism or anything like that. Critical race theory roils a Tennessee school district, right? And it's about, you know, these big, you know, the what we've been seeing, you know, these school board meetings and people fighting. And in particular, there's one woman's testimony that went sort of viral, right? Because she's like, we need to just stop this attack against white people and all this kind
of
stuff.
Yep.
Ready? But wait for the kicker, Matt, because you're going to love this one. Robin Steenum, an Air Force veteran and white mother of three, is fed up with the way public schools in her community of Franklin, Tennessee are teaching kids about race. She believes that the reading materials and teachers' manuals are biased, specifically the lessons taught to second graders about civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. His leave class believing that white people are oppressors and minorities are victims, Steenum claims. while her only school-aged child attends private school, Steenman nevertheless wants the public system, Williamson County Schools, to change its approach.
That is beautiful.
That's as juicy and as perfect as it gets. So all the populism that you get about the right, that it sort of represents the real feelings of the working people of this country, remember that the vast majority of the tribunes of this shit are fucking rich assholes who are worried about poor and working class people and the public in general being exposed to proper history.
That is unbelievable. Like, just like in an individual, as sort of like, man, I can't believe that.
That I got a lot of stuff on Robin Steenman I've been posting over the past couple of days. There's this thread I made about the 11-page grievance that they filed with the Tennessee School District, and it includes things that they complain about, things like the depiction of seahorses mating, and that's too graphic for the children to learn about. The effects of hurricanes, it's too violent. They can't learn about that. And they can't learn about Ruby Bridges' desegregation campaign in schools, because it just depicts the white people exclusively as oppressors, and it speaks to nothing of the good, to quote Robin Steenman. Yeah,
it's amazing.
You know, I mean, this is really, there was this brief moment where it's like, why do you care about that mascot nickname that is up for a Native American tribe that was genocided 150 years ago? Just let people play basketball. And now it's like, we can't teach Martin Luther King to
yeah, right. It, no, exactly. Critical race theory was quickly the claim that racism still exists. And now critical race theory is teaching kids that racism even ever existed.
Existed, yeah. That, I mean, it's funny and it is horrifying when you think of like the actual effect that this sort of thing can have. I mean, we just released for public folks our talk on Blair Mountain, and he talked about the mind guard system, where they basically like had people enforcing intellectual or ideological control, and like obviously the schools were owned by the companies and stuff like that. And like, I also always bring up how George Orwell's when he says like, every word I was written against totalitarianism, and then the next phrase was and for democratic socialism, how to like 50 million American kids who read the Penguin version of that, that for democratic socialism was removed. There's ellipses there. You need to put ellipses for three words in a book that's like, you know, you could obviously it's an ideological concern more than a size one. And that's what really elite civilization needs to do. This is a necessary activity, basically, and it's scary, and it sucks that to the extent if you have an aunt that's getting really freaked out about their kid being taught to be an oppressor or something like that, it's sad. But I think, like, I don't know, it's not gonna recede until the next campaign season.
No, they found it. They found something for their base, and they're capitalizing on it, and they're not letting go. This critical race theory thing is gonna come up again and again till at least through 2022. And I've seen people talking about it the way that they talk about the war on Christmas. Like it could come up whenever, you know. Yeah, like Fox News does it herpes every Christmas season. We'll see how long this one lasts.
Yeah. Well, Sam Holdybrill, where should people go to follow your work?
To follow my work, people can follow me on Twitter. So they can just search Sam Holdybrill. That's HODLEY-BRILL. Or Twitter.com/ Deon Teleologist, DEONTELEOLOGIST. And that's where I'm at.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Sam.
Yeah, and, folks, pleasure.
We will see you Wednesday.